All right, let's get into another deep dive. And today we are taking a look at the State v. Davis case. This one really went the distance all the way up to the Oregon Supreme Court, and actually more than once, which is kind of crazy. We've got court opinions and some legal documents to dig into. This is going to be interesting because it's not just about figuring out who did it this time. We're going to be talking about the fine details of legal procedure and how even what seemed like small things about evidence can actually have a huge impact on a case.
Yeah, and one of the most interesting things about State v. Davis is that it really shines a light on something called harmless error. That's a legal doctrine that can be pretty important when a case goes to appeal. It can make or break a case sometimes. But to understand how it all works, we kind of have to set the stage first, right?
Yeah.
So we're talking about Cornelius Davis, and he was convicted of murdering his partner. She died from a gunshot wound to the head.
Okay, so pretty straightforward so far.
Yeah, well, except that Davis's defense was that she actually committed suicide. And he did have some evidence to back that up, too. There was a history of her making statements about wanting to end her own life.
Oh, okay. So that seems like pretty relevant information for the jury to consider, right?
You'd think so, right? You would definitely think so. But here's where things get a little bit tricky. The trial court actually decided to exclude some of those statements. The judge said they were too old, basically. They were made too long ago to be relevant.
Huh. Interesting. So that's where the idea of harmless error comes into play.
Exactly. Exactly. The concept of harmless error basically says that, okay, even if there was a mistake during the trial, it's not automatically grounds for overturning the verdict. It only matters if that mistake, that error, likely affected the outcome of the trial.
So in the case of Cornelius Davis, did the courts think that excluding those statements about suicide was a harmless error?
Well, that's where it gets really, really interesting. The Oregon Supreme Court actually overturned Davis's murder conviction, and they specifically said it was because of those excluded statements. They were like, no, 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 keeping those statements out of the trial, that wasn't just some minor procedural whoopsie, that was a big deal. They called it a harmful error. They said it potentially robbed Davis of a fair trial.
Wait, hold on. So even if the court thought Davis might actually be guilty, they still overturned the whole thing just because the process wasn't fair? That seems like kind of a big deal.
It is a big deal, absolutely. The Supreme Court was basically saying, look, it's not up to us to decide whether this guy's guilty or innocent at this point. That's not what this is about. The question is whether the evidence that was kept out of the trial, could that evidence have reasonably changed the minds of the jury? And in this case, they decided, yes, absolutely, it could have. And that's what matters. And I think this concept of harmless error really forces us to consider what the whole purpose of a trial is in the first place. It's not just about getting a conviction. It's about making sure the entire process is fair and just, even if in the end the defendant is found guilty.
That's a really interesting distinction. It really highlights how important it is to the courts that everything is done fairly. So what happened next? Did they just let Davis go?
Well, not exactly. It's not quite that simple because remember, the original conviction was thrown out because of that procedural error with the evidence, right?
Yeah.
But the prosecution could still choose to try him again, and that's what they did.
So round two for State v. Davis. Same charge, new trial. What happened?
Well, this is where things get even more complicated. So get ready, because Davis gets convicted again. But this time, the sentence he got was actually harsher. And that brings up a whole new set of legal questions and issues that I think are worth talking about.
Oh, wow. So we've gone from questions about the evidence to questions about his sentence. This case is all over the place. So what were some of the key sentencing issues that came up in Davis's case?
Well, one of the biggest things that came up had to do with something called State v. Turner. That was a different case that set a legal precedent. It basically said that if someone wins an appeal and then they have to go through another trial, they can't be given a longer or harsher sentence the second time. It's all about making sure people can appeal a case without being afraid of being punished for it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So did Davis's lawyers try to use the Turner case to get his sentence reduced?
Oh, yeah, absolutely they did. They said that giving him a harsher sentence after he won his appeal was totally unfair and went against his rights. But the court didn't agree with them in the end.
Really?
Mm.
Why not? I mean, he did win his appeal, right?
Yeah, he did. But remember, his first conviction was totally thrown out because of that mistake with the evidence, right? So it's like, legally speaking, that first trial never even happened. It was a complete do-over.
Oh, I see. So because it was basically a brand new trial, the court felt like they could start fresh with a sentencing, too.
Okay, but you said there were a couple of sentencing issues in this case, right?
You got it. There was another sentencing issue, but this one wasn't about the murder charge. It was about the firearms charge.
Ah, right. He was also convicted of being a felon in possession of a firearm. What happened with that?
Well, this is where things get kind of interesting. Davis actually won, at least partly, on this one. The court decided that the trial court had made a mistake when they were sentencing him for the firearms charge. They said they didn't follow an important legal precedent, which is the Blakely case.
Okay, Blakely. Refresh my memory here. What was the Blakely case all about? I feel like it has something to do with juries deciding on sentences, right? Yeah, you're on the right track. Blakely v. Washington, that's the full name, basically said that a judge can't just decide to give someone a longer sentence than the guidelines allow just because they think it's the right thing to do. Hmm. If they're going to do that, they have to base that decision on things the jury specifically decided on, not just on what the judge thinks.
Okay, so it's all about making sure the jury has a say in what the sentence is going to be, and not just the judge calling all the shots. That makes sense. It's an important check and balance there. But how does that all apply to Davis's case?
So in Davis's case, the court basically ignored what the jury had decided on when they were figuring out his sentence for the firearms charge. And the Supreme Court was like, no way. That's not how this works. They said that part of the case had to go back to the lower courts so they could sentence him again. And they said this time they had to follow the Blakely rule. No cutting corners. It's kind of like, imagine you're making a cake and the recipe tells you to put in 1 cup of sugar. Blakely is like saying, hey, you can't just decide to put in 2 cups of sugar because you think it'll taste better. You have to follow the recipe unless it gives you different options. And in this case, the recipe is the law, and it says the jury gets to help decide on how much sugar goes in the cake, so to speak. They get to decide on the things that will affect the sentence.
I love that analogy. That's really helpful. So basically, Davis got a longer sentence for the murder charge, and the court was okay with that because technically it was like a whole new trial. But he got a win on the firearms charge because they didn't do things the right way when it came to the jury's role in his sentencing. Man, this case is like a roller coaster.
It really is. But there's one more twist we got to talk about before we wrap things up. I mean, think about it. With all those appeals and trips to the Supreme Court, this whole thing must have taken forever, right? Did they violate Davis's right to a speedy trial?
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. I bet a lot of our listeners are wondering the same thing. All those trials and appeals and back and forth, it must have taken years to figure all this out.
It did take a long time, but you might be surprised to hear this. The courts actually decided that Davis's right to a speedy trial wasn't violated. And the reason why is actually pretty interesting.
So last we left off, we were talking about whether all of those appeals and all that back and forth to the Supreme Court violated Davis's right to a speedy trial. And you were about to tell us why the court said it didn't.
Right. So basically, the reason they said his right to a speedy trial wasn't violated is because most of the delays, most of that extra time, was actually because of Davis's own appeals. It's like you can't really complain that things took too long when you were the one who kept asking for more time. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that does make sense. The court's basically saying, look, you wanted to appeal and you won some of those appeals. So you can't turn around and say the process took too long because of those appeals. It's like you said, kind of a catch-22. But after all of that, after all those appeals and trials and everything, where did things end up for Cornelius Davis? Did all that even change anything?
Well, in the end, the outcome was pretty much the same. His murder conviction stuck, and he's still in prison. But that doesn't mean it was all a waste of time, you know?
But if he still ended up in prison, what was the point of all those appeals? How can you say they weren't meaningless?
Well, because they brought up some really important points about how our legal system works, and they made the courts really think about what fairness and due process really mean. Remember, the very first time he was convicted, they overturned that because of those statements about the victim thinking about suicide that weren't allowed in court. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty big win for the defense, and it just goes to show that everyone deserves a fair trial, even if they end up being found guilty.
I see what you mean. It's not just about what happens in the end. It's about making sure the whole process is fair from beginning to end. So looking back at this whole State v. Davis case, what are the key things we should take away from it? What makes this case stand out, besides just being another murder trial?
Well, I think this case really shows how important it is to get the evidence right. What's allowed in court and what's not allowed, that can totally change how the jury sees the case, and it could definitely change what they decide. It shows that even little mistakes with procedure can have huge consequences in the end. Imagine it like a puzzle, right?
Yeah.
If you're missing a piece or two, you can probably still see the whole picture, but it's not complete. It's the same with a trial. The jury needs all the important pieces of evidence to make a decision that's fair and makes sense.
Right. It's like those statements about the victim's suicidal thoughts. That was a missing puzzle piece that the court said had to be included.
Exactly. And this case goes even deeper than that. It looks at how sentencing guidelines work and all the complications involved in that. We even saw some of the biggest Supreme Court cases come up, like State v. Turner, which is about what happens when someone wins an appeal and has to be sentenced again, and Blakely v. Washington, which says that juries have a really important role in figuring out sentences, not just the judge.
So this case was about way more than just whether one guy was guilty or not. It ended up clarifying some really important legal concepts that matter in tons of other cases, too.
Right. And it shows that the law is always changing and evolving. New cases come up, and courts have to figure out how the old rules apply to those new situations. Sometimes that means looking at old cases in new ways or figuring out what the rules really mean when they're not clear. That's why it's so interesting to really dive deep into cases like this one. They give us a peek into how the legal system actually works, and they remind us that even the tiniest details can have a big impact on the law. If this case were a song, it wouldn't be a simple pop tune. It would be a whole symphony with different movements and themes coming back again and again.
That's a great way to put it. And with that, we've reached the end of our journey into State v. Davis. We covered so much, from the original murder charge and those arguments about what evidence should be allowed in court, to the ins and outs of sentencing guidelines and whether he got a speedy trial.
It was a wild ride. And as always, we want to leave you with something to think about. Put yourself in the shoes of someone on the jury in one of Davis's trials. Would those statements about the victim and what she was going through, would that have made a difference to you? Would you have had reasonable doubt? It's something to think about because juries have a huge responsibility in our system. What they decide can literally change people's lives.
It really makes you think about how important it is to get things right in the courtroom. Thanks for coming along with us on this deep dive. We'll be back soon with another fascinating case that'll make you think about the law in ways you never expected.